It's wonderful to be together this morning with the light snow falling outside for those of us who are in Boston. So, our parsha for this week, Vayeshev, begins with the words, Vayeshev Yaakov, Jacob settled in the land where his father had sojourned. An ironic way to begin a story. Which will tell the tale of family conflict, fratricidal impulses, and a tragic upending of Jacob's life. This time in Jacob's life is anything but settled. This parsha launches the narrative of Joseph's descent into Egypt and the 400 years of exile of Jacob's descendants. It sets off a chain of dramatic shifts. In power, Joseph is cast into the pit by his brothers, hauled up by slave traders. He rises rapidly to take charge of running Potiphar's household, but his rise precipitates his arrest and getting cast down again into the dungeon with the king's prisoners. From there, he rises to a position of power in Pharaoh's court and he will implement a system of indentured servitude that will eventually make the Israelites powerless under the rule of subsequent pharaohs. This is hardly a narrative that you would expect to begin with. Jacob settled. Aviva Zornberg responds to this ironic introduction in her reflection on the problem of Jacob's longing to be settled in her book. The Beginning of Desire, Reflections on Genesis. She quotes from Rashi's commentary, Jacob sought to settle in peace, and suddenly there leapt upon him the agitation of Joseph. The righteous seek to settle in peace, and God says, it is not enough for the righteous what is prepared for them in the world to come. That they seek to settle in peace in this world? Jacob, she notes, would like to find tranquility after the turmoil of his years with Laban, his fearful return to the territory where he would have to confront the brother from whom he stole the birthright and the blessing that were his brother's due, and after the death of his beloved wife, Rachel. Rashi notes that in God's response, the righteous are made to seem almost greedy, their desire for peace in this world wrong-headed in view of the treasure awaiting them in another world. And of course, this commentary surprises us. Isn't that what we're doing, what we've been taught to do by our beloved meditation teachers to settle the busy mind so that we can see more clearly? Less pulled in every which way by the distractible mind? Is this considered the wrong thing to do in Jewish tradition? Zornberg points out that it is not wrong to settle in peace, but in tasting the sweetness of equanimity, the righteous will become greedy and will develop an overweening desire to settle, will seek with too great a need such a settling. Now, this interpretation seems to align better with our Buddhist-inspired teachings. Indeed, our practice is designed to settle the mind. And yet, as with all meditation experience, we get derailed when we seek a particular idealized experience of equanimity. Instead of using our clear and settled mind to respond skillfully, to the reality that is constantly evolving and never totally settled in this life. I'll follow Zornberg's path of inquiry through some of the midrashic sources that illuminate this theme in the narrative, and we'll keep returning as well to our practice of seeking equanimity through meditation. This exploration of the downside of seeking equanimity will not come as a surprise to those of us who may know people who use the serenity of meditation to escape or avoid the turmoil that is present in real life, in real relationships, and within all of us. When is meditation practice an escape from reality, and when is it settling the mind to see reality more clearly and to respond to reality more skillfully? The Midrash uses the term yeshuv hada'at, settling the mind, being clear-minded, also translated as equanimity, in contrast to its opposite, tiruf hada'at, literally, to be of a torn mind, to be confused, bewildered. This, Zornberg says, is a question of order as against disorder, clarity of against confusion, a question of composure. We'll keep coming back to the question, when we want to find order and clarity so very much, do we risk denying the wildness and disorderly confusion of real life? And if we deny that wildness, do we lose touch with the full meaning of life, with all its joys and sorrows? Zornberg highlights the psychological vulnerability that causes Jacob to avoid seeing the wildness, like the fratricidal impulses that are right there in front of him. From the start of Jacob's life, he's described as a mild man raising livestock, ish tam yoshev ohalim, a simple man who sits in tents. In contrast, Esau emerged from the womb red, like a hairy mantle all over. Esau means hairy or rough. The image of being born this way makes Esau seem like a wild animal himself. And when the boys grow up, Esau becomes a skillful hunter, and Jacob becomes a mild man, raising livestock. Esau likes to hunt wild things. Jacob's profession and success in life is based on protecting the herd from attacks by wild animals. Jacob experiences wildness as a threat, something to be avoided at all costs. Nevertheless, Jacob is able to trick his brother out of his birthright. And this is because of Esau's impulsive decision to trade his birthright for soup because he was so hungry at that moment. Unlike Esau, Jacob waits with patience and restraint for 7 years in order to marry Rachel, and then seven more after he's tricked into marrying Leah first. And during this time, he prides himself on his perfect protection of Laban's flock. When he finally takes leave of Laban, he says, Trefa lo haveti alecha. I never brought you an animal torn by beasts. The word trefa here has the same root as tiruf, as in tiruf hada'at, the confused, bewildered mind, the opposite of yeshuv hada'at, or equanimity. Well, those of us who know what comes next in the story probably have other associations to the word tarof, torn apart. The brothers hatch a plot to avoid telling their father the terrible truth that they have sold his most beloved son into slavery. They take Jacob's tunic that they had ripped off of him before casting him into the pit and dip it in goat's blood. They have it brought to their father and say, pray recognize whether it is your son's coat or not. And as soon as Jacob recognizes it, he says, my son's coat, a wild beast has devoured him. Yosef is torn to pieces. Tarof toref, says in Torah. The brothers, Zornberg points out, did not themselves have to tell Jacob this lie. For the image of Joseph being torn apart by wild beasts leaps into Jacob's mind. The sons understand their father's dread of wild things, and when they present him the coat, it has the desired effect of making Jacob himself leap to the conclusion that his son was torn apart by wild beasts. What Jacob fears the most, and what he has kept at bay all his years of being a successful shepherd, was actually lying in wait in his own mind, crouching like a beast itself to leap upon him when the bloody coat is presented. Zornberg quotes a midrash in which Jacob laments, "How could I have spent all those years protecting Laban's flock from being attacked, and now I could not even protect my own son?" Through her great scholarship and blending of midrash and psychoanalytic commentary, Zornberg connects Jacob's torment to his psychological avoidance of wildness, his wish to deal only with the orderly, and his inability to see clearly the disorder that is in his family and in himself. Blinded by his love of Joseph, Jacob cannot see the fratricidal impulses that he is stirring up by favoring Joseph over his older brothers. Jacob, who was only 17 at the time, tended the sheep as a helper to his brothers. He brings an ill report of them to their father. Now, Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph above all his sons, so he made him an ornamented coat. And when the brothers saw that their father loved Joseph above all his brothers, they hated him. So, as if oblivious to hatred, Joseph tells to their hatred, Joseph tells his brothers two provocative dreams about, first about their sheaves of wheat bowing down to his, and then about the sun and moon and stars bowing down to him. Jacob seems to almost pretend rebuke his son, as if showing support for the other brothers in a wish to protect Jacob from their rage. "What kind of dream is that that you have dreamt? Shall I, your mother, and your brothers bow down to you to the ground?" Well, there is a show of your rebuke. There is something odd about this interpretation, the obvious interpretation of Joseph's mother, the moon, and father, the sun. Because Joseph's mother died at the time of Benjamin's birth. So the idea of this dream predicting that mother, father, and brothers will one day bow down to him seems to miss an important element of the dream, that this dream may fulfill Joseph's wish for his mother to be alive, for the family to be whole, and for him to bask again in the light of his father, the sun, and his mother, the moon. So Jacob, oblivious to the seeds of hatred that he is planting and that he has sowed in the hearts of his older brothers, he sends Joseph out all alone to his brothers who are tending the flocks far away. Why didn't they all go out together? Why was Joseph sent out as a spy to bring back more bad reports? Is Jacob unable to see the wildness that is right in front of him because he is so intent on seeking a peaceful retirement? Rather than taking in the difficult reality of his family's hatred, he seeks to be settled, not seeing that he has set a trap for his beloved son and then sent him into it. Well, what does this have to do with meditation? Do we ever use meditation as an escape to avoid the difficult reality of our lives? And is that wrong? As I was trying to figure out how Aviva Zornberg's brilliant commentary fit into our meditation teachings, I was also reading another assignment from our wise aging group, a book we often quote, The Five Invitations, by Frank Ostaseski, discovering what death can teach us about living fully. The assigned chapter for this past month is called Turn Toward Your Suffering. He gives an example of unspeakable tragedy. One day, while writing at his desk, he picks up the phone and a man says, "We heard you might help us with our son dying of cancer." Frank thinks the man is seeking help as they anticipate the son's death, but no, the son has just died, just then, at home in his bedroom. Frank goes right over. He walks into the room and spontaneously bends over and kisses the 7-year-old boy on the forehead. His parents burst into tears. They had not known what to do. They had been frozen, not knowing how they would ever deal with this reality. Frank suggests that they bathe him, a slow, loving process that they had done so many times before, that allows them to make contact with the reality they fear. For those of us who know about the tradition of bathing the body and chanting the Psalms for the deceased, in Jewish tradition, and some among us have participated in this, in the Chevra Kedisha, the community group that does this practice. This way of coming to accept the unacceptable is in line with the wisdom of religious tradition. We have to turn toward our suffering in gradual physical ways that are brought to a different type of consciousness through the performance of rituals. Rituals can teach us how to approach suffering, bathing the body, sitting Shiva, Shlosh Shim, Yortzites. We turn towards suffering with the support of community and thousands of years of practice and repetition from which these healing traditions emerge. So suffering arises not just from tragic loss, but from everyday events. Being rejected by a loved one or a friend or a family member, being criticized at work, feeling guilty over unintended harm we have caused, feeling hurt and angry over harm caused to us, feeling disappointed in not meeting our own expectations, feeling physical pain and physical limitations that we never expected to have, and limitations that we feel just in aging. The list goes on. In an interview, Frank describes visiting a woman who is well aware she's dying. She is not in denial. When her health aide says, "Adele, you're shivering. Are you cold? Do you want a blanket?" Adele says, "Of course I'm cold. I'm almost dead." Even when her labored breathing was made more comfortable by medications and all the other palliative interventions, she still seemed to be struggling. Frank, who was waiting quietly in the corner to avoid all of Adele's rejections of help that he witnessed her doing with her aide, he moved closer and asked her whether she wanted to suffer less, and she nodded. He noticed the little pause at the end of each breath, which seemed like a place where she could momentarily rest. He told her to bring her attention to that little pause and that he would do it with her. She did, and she died peacefully not long after. Frank asks, can we find a place of rest right in the middle of things? He says we often try to manage the conditions so we can create a place of rest, like Jacob. We want a peaceful retirement. We always think that our rest will come from managing the conditions, says Frank, from going on vacation or getting our list checked off. I think, Frank says, we can find a place of rest right in the middle of things. Let's take a moment of silence.